meeting minutes for January 24th.
Mr. Chair, I give you a motion to accept the meeting minutes as shown in the agenda.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Done. This morning, we are very lucky to have Ms. Lori Oakham with us from the Office of Chief Counsel of the State Water Board that's going to bring us up to speed on the changes to the ex parte rules in the world that we live. So welcome, and thank you for coming over.
Thank you. Good morning. Is this? I'm going to speak about ex parte, but before I do that, I'm also going to address another bill that passed last year, AB 685, the Human Right to Clean Water. This bill provided that every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. The bill didn't establish any substantive requirements other than to consider this policy when revising, adopting, or establishing grant criteria and regulations. And the boards already have to do that under the anti-degradation policy and, excuse me, and Water Code Section 13241. So it won't establish substantive requirements for the boards. Could you excuse me for a moment? We need to take a break.
Take your time, please. So while we're waiting here for a minute, just so people know, we have a couple items. I'm thinking we'll go through, we have an uncontested item, which I believe will be very brief. We similarly have a item number six, which is, I believe, to be brief. We'll break for a minute and come back. The big item of the day is, I think everybody's anticipating, is item seven. So just so everybody's up to date. In fact, why don't we right now just take a 5-minute break while Ms. Hogan collects herself, and we'll be back. Actually, why don't we make it 9:15?
Yep.
No apology needed.
So the human right to clean water, although it won't make a lot of substantive changes in what the boards do, it is very significant because California is the first state in the world to codify the policy that there's a human right to clean water. It doesn't explicitly apply to permitting actions, but we do recommend that because it is state policy that any WDRs or permits or waivers that could affect MUN drinking water sources do make findings explaining how the requirements of the order are consistent with the right to clean water.
Well.
On to the ex parte rules. In general, prior to SB 965, there were two categories of board actions for purposes of the ex parte rules. First, quasi-legislative actions or rulemaking, which involves basin planning and TMDLs for the regional boards. For those types of actions, there are no ex-parte restrictions, so ex-parte communications are allowed. We do advise board members that for purposes of transparency, when you have meetings with stakeholders about pending basin planning actions, that you disclose those on the record just so everyone is aware of the communications, and also so that the decision that the board makes can be based on the whole record and not on conversations that occur outside of the record. For quasi-judicial matters, which include enforcement and permitting actions, ex-parte communications have been strictly prohibited. That includes any sort of communications with board members, with stakeholders. In prosecutorial matters, we enforce the ex parte restrictions a little more broadly so that in those matters, even the board's advisors don't engage in ex parte communications with the prosecution team or the discharger involved in those matters. In recognition of the fact that general orders are sort of a hybrid between a rulemaking action and a permitting action, the legislature enacted SB 965 so that ex parte communications are now allowed for general orders. And general orders are defined under the statute to mean orders that don't name all of the dischargers, but instead have an enrollment process where covered dischargers can seek coverage under the permit. General orders do include petitions of general orders to the state board. So if this board issues a general order, a waiver, general permit, and that's petitioned to the state board and they take up the petition, you can engage in ex parte communications on that petition with the state board members. The statute allows for a 14-day hold before the adoption hearing at which the board will be considering action on a general order. And there are two purposes for that. One is to allow the required disclosures to be made and posted on the internet before the board acts. I'll talk about the disclosure requirements in a minute. But basically, most dischargers and other stakeholders who want to talk to you outside of a board meeting have to post disclosure, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to take the action and then post the disclosure. So the 14 days gives time to post that disclosure, and it also protects the board members from being bombarded with requests for last-minute meetings when you're busy reading the agenda and preparing for the meeting. The 14-day hold is optional. It's imposed by the board. It doesn't require any formal board action, so generally staff include the 14-day ban language in the public notice of the action. And that will be done by the executive officer, usually in communication with the chair. If you want to have any input in terms of whether or not to impose that quiet period, we can discuss that today, or you can discuss it with Matt at another time. But the Office of Chief Counsel does recommend that you take advantage of that, at least until all the boards and the parties get used to the new process. The scope of the exception extends to both written and oral ex parte communications. I'm going to focus mostly on oral ex parte communications today because it's relatively straightforward in how we deal with letters or emails that come in that are sent directly to a board member as opposed to the staff. One thing to keep in mind is that SB 965 didn't make any change to any other applicable law. So the restrictions on serial meetings still apply. The quorum requirements still apply. So you can't have a quorum of the board meeting with a stakeholder without notice. We do recommend that you limit the meetings to two board members at a time. A quorum is three, but just in the interest of transparency, and because if fewer than the entire board is acting on a matter, three votes can actually carry a matter. So we recommend that you limit your meetings to one or two board members with other stakeholders. The due process, four is a quorum. So if three board members are meeting, there's not technically a quorum, but just more out of an abundance of caution, because if you have four board members or even five board members acting, three will carry the vote. Due process and bias restrictions still apply, and one of those rules is that decision makers can't make a decision until the record is complete and you've considered all the evidence. So board members should refrain from expressing any opinions on how you're going to vote. You can feel free to ask questions or express any concerns you have at a meeting about what the position that stakeholders are taking. But be careful not to say how you're going to vote on a particular matter. The serial meeting requirements still apply, so it would be improper for a stakeholder to try to build a consensus by meeting sequentially with the various board members. So be aware of stakeholders that are meeting with one board member and start telling you, well, I met with another board member, and here are the questions, here are the concerns, here's how I think that board member is going to vote. Those sorts of conversations are improper. But of course, if you're meeting with a stakeholder who has a particular view, we expect that they're going to be presenting the same opinions, arguments, information to all of the board members. That's perfectly appropriate, and that's obviously what the statute contemplates. Another thing to keep in mind is that the hearing procedures still govern the record. So the disclosure requirements require that stakeholders attach any handouts they use at the meeting, and those disclosures will be posted on the internet. But this isn't an opportunity to provide late written materials to augment the record. It's just for purposes of information and discussion. Finally, ex-party site visits are treated a little bit differently than other sorts of meetings. Ex-party site visits, or any type of site visit, constitutes evidence. It's like a field inspection by staff. So we do recommend that if you want to visit a site that's the subject of a general order, that you do work with counsel. We recommend providing notice for a couple of reasons. One is that the purpose of these meetings isn't to augment the record. It's just to allow stakeholders to present their views to you. So any treatment processes, sites that you view, that's considered evidence. It should be available to other members of the public. In some cases, members of the public don't have access to view these sites that you would be seeing, especially in some of the agricultural regulations. It's very difficult for members of the public to get access to private property. So in the interest of transparency, we suggest making that opportunity available to members of the public the same way it is to board members. And then finally, the disclosure requirements say that you have to attach any materials that are used in the ex parte communication, and it's unclear how to do that in the case of a site visit. We could have staff document that with notes and photographs, but it's easier just to provide notice to the public. So if you do get those sorts of invitations or you're interested in setting up a site visit, I suggest that you work with counsel to set that up. There are three categories of stakeholders who have to disclose ex parte communications. Those include potential enrollees in the permit and their representatives and employees. Anyone with a financial interest in the permit, and that's the same sort of interest that you would have to report on Form 700. And the representatives and employees of those persons, and anyone who's acting on behalf of an organization that is taking a position on the permit. So an environmental organization, a formally organized neighborhood association, trade organization. This doesn't require disclosure by a member of the public who happens to be a member of the Sierra Club or a trade organization. It's only when they're acting on behalf of that organization. Other members of the public are free to meet with you on an ex parte basis on general orders, but they do not have any disclosure requirements. We recommend that board members do the sort of disclosure for those meetings where disclosure is not required, in the same way that you would for a basin planning action. Just disclose on the record who you met with and generally what you talked about. And that's in the interest of transparency. It's not a legal requirement. SB 965 puts the responsibility for disclosure on the member of the public, not on the board member. So it's not up to the board members to complete the disclosure. We've created forms that are posted on all of the regional board's websites that list the information that has to be disclosed so that people can just go to the website, fill out the form. You can print those forms and bring them with you if you're meeting with stakeholders and hand those out. What must be disclosed is the date, time, location of the meeting, the participants in the meeting, what you talked about, and a copy of any materials that were used at the meeting. We haven't had problems yet. This law's only been in effect for a couple months, but there have not been any problems yet with inadequate disclosures. Typically, anyone who wants to meet with you to talk about a pending general order will already have submitted written comments. So about half of the disclosures I've seen just attach the written comments and include the information on the date and time and participants, and that's enough disclosure. What we do recommend is that you let Matt or counsel know when you're going to be having an ex parte meeting so we can track whether we received the disclosure. It has to be provided by the discharge or by the stakeholder within 7 working days of the meeting. So we know that if we don't get something that's expected, either the board member or staff can follow up with the stakeholder to get the disclosure submitted. If the disclosure is inadequate, if we think it doesn't include a robust enough discussion of what the meeting involved, then we will contact the discharger or request that you do that to have them supplement the disclosure. If that doesn't work, board members can also supplement the disclosure either in writing, and we can post that on the internet with the disclosure, or you can do that on the record of the meeting. SB 965 does provide that the board can impose contempt sanctions if the disclosure requirements aren't complied with, but I really can't imagine a situation where we would have to resort to that. We really are going to be working with stakeholders to help them do the disclosure. Once the board gets the disclosure, it's posted on the website, and an email goes to the LIRIS list, all of the interested persons who have subscribed to our notices for that item. We will not be including copies of the disclosures in board member packets or agenda binders, because these aren't the same as written comments or letters that you receive on the item. You can go to the website if you're interested to see who other board members have been meeting with and what they've been talking about, but they won't be routinely provided. This is a link to the disclosure forms. You don't need to write it down. There's a link from the front page of your website to the disclosure form, and also a copy of the Office of Chief Counsel's ex parte question and answer document. It's been updated to provide more information on SB 965. It's questions 28 through 35. And I can answer any questions you have.
Lori, first, thank you for not only coming over here today, but for the Office of Chief Counsel trying to keep people like us out of trouble. You know, ex parte is something that as a, you know, entering into the system as a board member and trying to walk into it on a monthly basis or otherwise to try and keep that straight. So thank you very much. I also want to take the opportunity to thank your staff, because I have realized very quickly along this road that both Samantha Olson and David Rice do a great job of keeping us out of trouble, and they are very good at it. At the same time, a couple questions. When does an order become an order? Because it's interesting that, you know, the omelet starts to get made and the conversation starts to be had. We get briefed. We actually get taken on field trips and we talk to people, and that is our job. But in my understanding, it's when it becomes posted or it is a noticed order it's kind of round and third and coming to home for adoption. And is that still correct in your point of view?
It's when staff notices the first evidentiary hearing or workshop on the order where there's actually a draft order ready. A lot of times these orders are many years in the making, and there are workshops developing, more of a policy scale type of workshop. It's not pending at that point. It's when the first order is actually published, the first proposed order.
Okay.
Like in other cases where there are ex parte restrictions or limitations, we recommend complying with the ex parte disclosure requirements when something's impending. But that's more to avoid the situation where, you know, staff is going to publish something next week and somebody's trying to contact board members at that point to avoid the disclosure requirements.
And then finally, a request, because it sounds like this is also a process of kind of figuring out how this is actually going to work. So as that happens, I'm sure we'll either have opportunities at WQCC or other gatherings with Michael Offer and Office of Chief Counsel or with our own attorneys here that could keep us up to date. But a request on my part would be to keep us up to date as we know more about how this mechanism is really going to work. So any other comments or questions for Lori?
Mr. Chair.
No,
go ahead.
He was quick on the draw. Mr. St. John.
Lori, if a member, a stakeholder, if an item is pending and a stakeholder requests to have a communication with a board member, can a board member decline that request?
Yes, you don't have to take ex parte meetings. One thing actually that's come up in another region is there are some stakeholders who announced that they were planning to meet with the board members as soon as the order came out, and every time staff proposed any changes to the order. Obviously, that places unreasonable demands on your time. So you're free to accept as many meetings as you'd like to. You're free to decline meetings, either if you have time constraints, you don't feel that they would be useful, you know, in some cases there are multiple stakeholders espousing the same viewpoint. One thing I would recommend is to look at the requests you get for meetings and make sure that you're meeting with a broad range of stakeholders. I think the requests from NGOs tend to come in a little bit later in the process. There's no requirement to give equal time, but just in the interest of good government, that's what we recommend. And in the San Francisco region, some of the board members were concerned that the NGOs wouldn't have the resources to engage in these kind of meetings, and they were thinking about providing extra time at the hearing to reflect any time that the board members were spending outside of the hearing. And those are the sorts of things that you can consider when it's time to establish the hearing procedures.
Mr. Messi, did you have a question?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And thank you for coming, Lori. I noticed that you came to defend poor Mr. Moore, who brought his own attorney with him. I guess that's how we stay out of trouble. But is it my understanding that essentially 965 does not so much change our world as it does the world of those that might be before us in terms of having to report this activity? I know that many of us have toured, in my case, as Mr. Noren is fond of pointing out to me, I know more about sewer systems than I go look at them, okay? Obviously, they are permitted circumstances, and I guess the question is who has to provide that ex parte communication? Is it the operator of the system, because I doubt seriously that he knows anything about 965, or is it the management? Who is responsible for doing that?
First of all, SB 965 only applies when there's a general order pending, and typically we don't regulate sewer systems through general orders, so nothing may change with respect to sewer systems. If there's nothing pending, then you can go talk to whomever you'd like, you can go look at whatever you'd like, and you don't need to disclose that unless you think it would be interesting to other board members and you want to disclose it as part of the meeting. If something were pending, a general order were pending at that point, if someone's actually hosting the site visit or initiating a conversation with you and they fall within one of those three categories, then they would have to do the disclosure. If you were working on a winery waiver and you happened to drive by a vineyard, that's not something that we would recommend disclosing. That doesn't rise to the level of a site visit, but there probably wouldn't be any change in that example.
Okay, only because they may be involved in a WDR rather than a general permit of a WDR sort.
Right, and if there were a WDR pending and you were looking at the sewer system that was subject to that WDR, that's still subject to the ex parte restriction. So we could arrange for a site visit, but there'd have to be notice.
I guess in my own mind, I'm thinking that if we do go look at this, there is the potential for WDR, that it's almost incumbent upon us to inform them that now that you've talked to me, you got to turn yourself in.
Well, and our general advice, if somebody approaches you at another meeting at the grocery store and wants, or calls you and wants to have a meeting about something that doesn't fall within a general order where ex parte communications are allowed, are that you first check with Matt to see if there's anything pending or ask the person. Usually if somebody is going to go to the effort of contacting a board member to talk about a specific site, it's because their permit is pending and they want to talk to you about it. So in that case, you can direct them to submit comments in writing for the record, and you can let them know that if they engage in ex parte communications with you, that you may be forced to recuse yourself later. That's usually enough, because people tend to approach the board members that they think are going to be sympathetic to them, and they don't want to lose your ability to participate.
Thank you.
Can I just provide one additional clarification? What the main thing that distinguishes a general order is when there's not a specific named discharger.
Right.
If it's a specific named discharger, then it's not a general order, and the ex parte already applies the probe. So
and that hasn't changed.
That hasn't changed.
Well, and the one thing, you know, you were here this morning. I think the things that we disclose under ex parte may, in fact, not be ex parte most of the time. Right. But we do it, I think, because it informs ourselves of what others are doing, keeps, I think, the general audience also informed of what we're doing. And then also, I think, at the end of the day, disclosure sets you free from the standpoint of just being honest about what you're doing out there. So please come back and keep us informed about, you know, how this works out in the long run. I really do appreciate you coming today, and I appreciate your work.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Okay, we're going to move on to uncontested items. As Matt St. John indicated, item number 4.